It's 6 p.m., so I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. I don't see, we don't officially have approval of the agenda here, right? So we don't need to vote on that or anything? Okay. So I think we can just start with introductions. And so I'll go ahead and start. I'm David Switzer. I'm the chair of the Water and Light Advisory Board. And so I'm really, really excited to have you all. And let's go from this end. So we can have
Philip Frasica, board member.
I'm Greg Coffin, the vice chair.
Tom Jensen, board member.
Amanda Jacobs, new board member.
Yeah, and I do want to extend, we'll do a formal introduction tomorrow at our regular meeting, but I do want to extend a welcome to Amanda, our newest member of the board. And so really, really excited to have everyone here to give us input. I want to apologize. I scheduled my booster shot for yesterday, so I'm a little under the weather, not feeling super great. My apologies for that. Just as a kind of mention on how we're going to proceed here, we have a series of topics with general comments at the end. I would ask that anybody keep it to 3 minutes on any given topic. Please keep your comments to the topic being discussed when we're discussing it. So I'm going to have to be pretty strict about both keeping on topic and the 3 minutes. And we would also ask that you avoid repeating the same comment in multiple sections of the public input meeting. So we're going to go through topics. There will be time at the end for general comments if we didn't address what you want to address. And so if you have something we are not going to talk about, you will have an opportunity at the end to do that. But I would ask again that you keep to the topic we're being discussed when we're on that topic and avoid repeating. And again, keep to 3 minutes. And so I think with that, we can move into the first thing we wanted to kind of get input on. And we don't have a presentation for this necessarily. It's kind of just the vision. I want to start kind of at 10,000 feet. What is the vision for the Water and Light Advisory Board? And what is our role in kind of the city, right? What should we be doing? What do you as citizens expect us to be doing? What is your expectations of us? In a perfect world, what would the role of the Water and Light Advisory Board be? And so, you know, what do you think we should be doing as a vision, right, for the board? I don't know if anybody else has any other comments. I kind of just wanted to see if the public had any thoughts on that. And please do introduce yourself when you come up. Thank you so much.
I'm Sarah Reed, 3802 Bedford Drive. The role of the Water and Light Advisory Board is actually in the charter, and it's advisory. Water and Light and the Director of Water and Light are in charge of engineering and operation, and they are qualified to do that. And it's not the job of the Water and Light Advisory Board to do that for them, to overrule it, and particularly to overrule it for political or ideological reasons. And I think there's been some slip on that in the last few years, so I'm hoping the new board doesn't go there. I think the role of the Water and Light Advisory Board is to be an honest broker of information for the public and to focus specifically on the reliability, efficiency, and cost effectiveness of the necessary utility services that we have, and to partner with the public and understand that hiding the ball is not the role. Sharing clear, coherent information and putting the hard choices in front of the public and facilitating that discussion is the role of the advisory board, and also keeping an eye on the books and making recommendations as appropriate to city council. But that's what we'd ask you to be, do. Keep your eye on the ball and be an honest broker of information.
Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate it. Any other comments on vision?
Hi, Julie Ryan, Camo Safe Water Coalition. I think when we think of vision, that the hope is that the Water and Light Advisory Board is a watchdog, that you are a board that looks out for what is happening, what is coming, works as the appropriate liaison to staff and the council, but also interprets and accepts the public's input and makes sure that that is being seen, heard, and evaluated and acted upon. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. All right. Anybody else before we move to more specific topics? All right, I think we can move into the first of the kind of major topics we wanted to hit, which is advanced metering infrastructure. And so this is something that, and I'm kind of using the slides that staff presented to council over the summer, I forget the exact date. But this is something very exciting that came out of the IARMP task force, the Integrated Electricity Resource Plan and Master Plan. And so this is something exciting that has a lot of potential to impact both the electric utility, but also the water utility, and opens up all types of opportunities. And so advanced metering infrastructure allows for a meter that communicates through a citywide wireless network. So instead of having people go around in trucks to meet readers, there is a wireless network that communicates and gives far more real-time information, far shorter increments than monthly information about the bills, that then customers will have more detailed information about their water bill. So it's a very exciting opportunity. A lot of cities have done it. A lot of private utilities obviously have done it. Some of you may be familiar with it from other areas. And it's something exciting that the utility is looking into and that the Water and Light Advisory Board is excited about. And so I think we can look at some of the benefits. And so, like I said, there's real-time data collection. So it's not this monthly impact in terms of the water rate or the bill collection, right, and billing. You get real-time data rather than monthly data. Fewer labor hours, right? Instead of having people driving collection routes, you can have it all done wirelessly. It leads to more efficient and timely account turnover, and so it increases efficiency. As Sarah said, efficiency is important, and so this would increase efficiency. And then it would also help with outages. If you get outages, you could get quicker notification of those. And it also has really nice long-term benefits. AMI opens up a whole ton of possibilities in terms of flexible billing design for demand charges, time of use. There's lots of opportunities to use billing in conjunction with AMI for a rate structure that makes more sense, that matches usage in a more accurate way. It can also let us look into solar generation and interact with smart devices. As EVs become more and more of the market, it's going to help with timing of vehicle charging. That's going to be a large kind of impact on the utility. And so with AMI, you can create rate structures that incentivize people to charge their electric vehicles off peak in really nice ways. You can do things with smart thermostats. It also opens up tons of new energy efficiency and demand side management programs that would be really exciting. And so lots of exciting possibilities. The next steps as part of the fiscal year 23 budget, there's going to be a consultant hired for pre-design and refining the budget that came out of the IARMP. Over the next 3 years, there is scheduled to have $24 million in capital projects starting next fiscal year to start the process of putting in AMI meters. But this is very early in the process. And so what we kind of wanted to know is whether anybody had thoughts on kind of the moving forward with AMI or concerns or, you know, other potential benefits. And so that's kind of the first big topic we wanted to hit was AMI. And so any comments?
It's also relevant to point out that some of the technology specifically for AMI serving electric will also be able to translate to the water side,
yeah,
for like Inner Clean Water Coalition. Yep. Technologies will straddle both sides of the house.
Yeah, it helps create. You'd be able to create new water efficiency programs as well using AMI.
My dad, I've got a property out of town, and I have AMI on that property. It's real nice. I can check see the usage. If there's an outage, I know about it, which might be important because I might need to go down and check the freezer or whatever it may be. So it's really nice to have. And they also, when I signed up for it for that particular area, had bill flexibility. It's the first time I went to a utility. They said, well, when do you want to pay your bill? So they gave you a window, but you could decide what makes sense for you. And so I think that's one advantage that AMI can provide for a community member, more flexibility and more information in their use of utilities.
We hope the lack of comments means you're as excited about the possibility as we are. So
I can feel it.
Yeah, feel the excitement. okay, so I think we can move to communications then if nobody has any comments. And so I think we're going to start with actually a brief presentation. And so one thing that we're working on in the Water and Light Advisor Board right now is improving communications with the public, improving communications with council, improving communication with other boards and commissions. But we also wanted to have a presentation from the Be Heard Como, which is able to give information about ongoing projects and is a new tool for the city to give really cool information. And so, yeah.
By the way, I'm Nate Fain. I'm in the city manager's office, a public information specialist. Do we know, is this the laptop that's hooked up to these monitors? Okay, so a little less than a year ago, the city manager approached us with an idea he had for a new platform for engagement, a way that residents could come to a website and share their input on different city projects. They could learn more about different city projects, and they could track the city projects as, you know, different departments progress through them. And so we put together Be Heard Como. We are in still a bit of a trial period with it, but we're working towards getting every single department to have at least one project on there. Utilities has had several projects on here, and I'll just kind of take you guys through the platform as it looks to the public when they use it. So just at the top of the page, it's just basically a rundown of what the website's all about. And then we get into our sort of loan call out for our ARPA page. There's a lot of public feedback involved. You know, over $12 million of funding we're trying to allocate with the help of the public. So that gets kind of its own call out. But when you get down here, you kind of see more of the projects. And as we scroll through it, you'll see a few utility projects on here. One of the first projects we launched was the McBain water treatment plant upgrades. I'll just show you guys what that looks like here. So on this page, you can learn about the project, read about it, read about the upgrades. It gives you direct lines of contact with city officials and employees. There are certain widgets like, you know, frequently asked questions here. You can post videos that take you through certain projects. Residents can ask questions, which can be answered, you know, either just solely on the back end, so only they see the answer through email, or publicly here. So that maybe if it's a question other people has, it will also get answered. On some of our other pages, we've experimented with other tools that the website offers. On this Be Heard implementation page, you'll see some examples of that here. There's this ideas section where registered users can post comments and ideas, and other residents can like or comment those. Sort of depends on whichever project, you know, you're putting out there, but for the ones that are maybe less controversial, this sort of feedback mechanism has been constructive in a lot of ways. There's also a survey tool, which allows for different sort of question structures. I don't know if you guys are familiar with like Google Forms or anything like that, but it's pretty similar to that. You know, you have multiple choice, you can choose, or you could rank, you could do like the scaled questions where it's like 1 to 5, somewhat agree, you know, completely agree, somewhat disagree, completely disagree, that sort of thing. And we get, on the back end, we get all sort of the responses to that, and we can really look at reports that really break down the parts of the page that our users are using, whether they're interacting to the level of actually using the tools, actually posting an idea, asking a question, filling out a survey, or if they're just reading on the page or clicking a link or something like that. So it does give us the ability to not only directly interact with residents in unique ways, but also keep track of how they're interacting on the platform. One thing I will say is that we usually prefer registration on the pages. Other than ARPA, to interact or to do any of these tools, you do have to register an account. But all that really requires is your email, a username, which doesn't have to be, you know, your first and last name. We do ask some optional demographic questions, but again, those are just for the user to answer if they please. We have over 1,500 registered users. Almost all of those users have actually interacted with some of the tools we have. We're working hard to continue to promote it on our various social channels. The goal of this is not necessarily to move everything here, but more create a place that provides not only deeper level of content on each project, but really allows residents to engage and feel like, you know, their voice is heard in this process. If you guys have any questions, probably now's a good time.
I had a question. Is it suited for like a board or commission to get input, or is it more project oriented?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I would say it's more project oriented, but that doesn't mean a board and commission can't take one of the projects you guys are working on and make a page out of it. The Vision Commission, they wanted some feedback on the city's strategic plan. So what they did is they took the 5 sort of prongs of the strategic plan and made 5 different short surveys that residents could answer. The thinking was, you know, if you didn't want to answer questions about one aspect of the strategic plan, you wouldn't have to. You could just answer questions on the point of the strategic plan that you cared most about. But I mean, short answer is yeah, it's more for projects.
There's a manager assigned, or like for a utility project, is there somebody from the utility that's managing the content?
Right. Yes. See here on this Be Heard implementation page, that is the city's web developer, Christian DeVerger. Matt Nestor is usually like the point of contact on, and the page manager on the utilities pages. And I help administer all the pages on the site, so it's kind of a team effort. In terms of the number of city employees that could be helping out on one project, you can get a pretty high number. So like on ARPA, we have, I can't remember the exact number, but more than 5 people have the ability to sort of keep the project fresh, add things to it, provide updates, adjust the content, monitor responses, things like that.
I think one of the reasons we wanted to have this here is you know, giving input to us is useful, but ultimately we are an advisory board, right? We you know, can be advisory, and we can take in public comment and use that, but ultimately you know, directly interacting with city staff and city officials through something like Be Heard Como is you know, also an avenue to maybe have a more direct impact or a direct link to these projects. But thank you. Really appreciate it.
Yep. Cool.
Excellent.
Thanks.
And so now I wanted to talk a little about what we're, as the board, doing. Do we have ability to switch it back? Oh, okay. What we as the board are doing to change our communication, to kind of streamline things. And so one thing that we have done is we've created a new public email. One issue we've had in the past is members of the public were emailing individual board members with comments pretty frequently. And it was kind of our belief that this was not necessarily the most efficient way to facilitate communication with the board. And so now anytime we get an email from a member of the public, we kind of push them to this email so we can, and we will now, going into the future, now this is out here, we're going to have a part at the beginning of the meeting to discuss emails we have received via this email address. So we wanted to put this out here. You know, this way people don't email one of us, it gets lost in our email, and then it doesn't, you know, we don't answer it, right? We're all, you know, volunteers with busy schedules, and so we wanted to make this really communication with the board a board communication. And so if you have comments that you don't give tonight, we would ask that you submit them to wlabpublic@como.gov. If you send any of us individual emails, we will probably tell you to go ahead and submit your comment to that email address. I think that's probably a more effective way of board communication. So that's one thing we're doing. And also, yes, on the website, there is a contact this board button that also will send emails to that email address. And that goes to all of us. We only meet once a month, so you know, if you send it right after our monthly meeting, we won't get to it until the next monthly meeting. So do keep that in mind, that since we are a board that meets monthly, that is when you'll get a response, because it will be coming from the board as a whole. And so, yeah, on the city website, you can also contact, which will send an email to the board. And then finally, I wanted to quickly talk about kind of...
Before we get to that, I want to add an additional note about that email. Is if it's something that's, you know, an issue with the city utility, don't go through that. I mean, that's just really to provide input to us. So if you got a billing issue, whatever it may be, go through the normal channels to contact the utility staff to get those clarified. We don't want this to become a different mechanism to deal with those day-to-day issues that the utility has with all the other consumers.
Yeah, we can't fix a main break, right? That's not necessarily the place you should go for that. And so I wanted to briefly also talk about some of the other things we're doing on communication. So we're trying to enhance our communication with council. We're really focusing on, and this was probably my fault, the last few memos we sent, we're going to try and shorten them up, make them as kind of concise as possible. And instead of an annual report to council, council probably tomorrow will be receiving our short quarterly report. Via email so the three kind of elements of this, we're going to go over our accomplishments or what we did the last quarter, our plans for the next quarter, and then important developments to note over the previous quarter. And so these will be quarterly instead of annually to try to, you know, kind of shorten the time of communication with council. And then when necessary, when we deem it appropriate, we will also make presentations during public hearings or the public comment period. And then the final thing that we're working on is enhancing our communication with other boards. And so when we feel like a memo or an endorsement memo is relevant to another board's work, we're going to share those, make sure they're CC'd on those. And we're going to share our short quarterly reports specifically with the CEC and the FAAC. And then we are, as much as possible, there's only five of us, and so we're kind of limited in terms of the numbers, and we're going to try and increase our attendance at CEC and FAAC meetings when they're dealing with relevant topics. And so with that, what I think we want from you all on this topic is there anything else we could be doing, and again, keeping in mind we are a volunteer board with, you know, limited hours, to enhance our communication ability. And so, you know, if the public has comments on how we can do that, I think we'd really appreciate that. Or is this good? All right, if that's good, that sounds good. well, hopefully that everybody's as on board with this, by what I've been working on as that. And so one of the things we're going to do in fiscal year 23 is work on water rate metrics. This is one of the big initiatives we're going to be doing. The goal of this is to develop a series of metrics that can be presented graphically over time to show the impact of different rate structures on the financial health of the utility, the affordability of rates, and interclass equity. And so really the goal here is to ensure that council has full information and the public has full information when decisions are being made. We're gonna use these metrics. We're not gonna adjust the rate structure, but we're gonna kind of encourage these metrics to be used in the fiscal year 24 budget process, and then develop a model that allows for these metrics to be used over and over again. So it's not just an annual thing that all you have to do is plug in the new numbers and it will spit out these same metrics. And so to give you guys a bit more detail, there'll be affordability metrics. And so the state of California, as well as a number of other cities throughout the country, Phoenix, Austin, Evansville, Illinois, a bunch of other cities, and the California Public Utilities Commission use the hours at minimum wage metric, where you express essential water use, so that you come up with a measure of what is essential water use for, you know, a family, and express that at hours at minimum wage, and then also essential water use expressed as a ratio with discretionary income. So for people with lower income families, you express the impact of the bill as the ratio with discretionary income. So you take the income estimate and then you subtract from that other utilities, cost of food, cost of housing, right? All these other elements, and it gives you a measure of affordability for whatever rate structure you're using. Again, both these measures have been used by the California Public Utilities Commission. And so the idea here is we're gonna use these metrics to estimate the impact of various rate structures on affordability. So, you know, there was a comment during kind of some of the discussions of the water rates this past fiscal year about, okay, what is the impact going to be on low-income customers? And so what we want is for us to have an answer to that, right? A clear answer to here's what the impact is based on these metrics, right? These established metrics. And the other kind of good thing about this is they can be used to measure affordability of other utilities as well. The California Public Utility Commission uses it for water, electric, communications, all types of utilities. And so they can be extended to these other utilities as well. The other thing that we're going to work on developing is a measure of interclass equity. And so most cost of service studies mostly focus on intra-class equity. So, you know, equity between residential, commercial, industrial, right, different classes of users. But there are measures, there are ways of measuring actually the cost of service of each individual customer. And so you can use a tailored rate that basically estimates how much is each individual customer costing the system. And then you can use those tailored rates to develop metrics of interclass equity that basically say, okay, compared to what they should be paying based on cost of service, what are they actually paying? And then there are two measures you can use to actually determine you know, whether we're in line with cost of service principles. So the first is a rate equity index. And so this is just taking like the total deviation from true cost of service. Again, you don't need to worry about this too much. It's just kind of measuring, you know, how much are people paying what they cost the system, right, is the idea of measuring this. And then a progressivity index that's not just total deviation, but how much, and I think I didn't finish my sentence there. I don't know what happened. How much higher volume users, higher cost of service users are paying compared to their rate versus lower cost of service. And so it's really about bringing this idea of equity, not social equity, but rate equity to intra-class, whereas previously it had only been applied to inter-class. And the last thing is we're gonna kind of reaffirm these revenue metrics. And so, you know, the utility has not been, hitting all of its revenue targets. We are, you know, the most recent rate adjustment will kind of bring us back in line with that. But we kind of want to reaffirm kind of what the goal is in terms of revenue. It all starts with revenue. Affordability starts with meeting revenue, you know, your financial obligations. And so we want to make sure we do that. And then the final element, the new thing, I'm back, Sarah, is, you know, the impact of weather variability on revenue. And so one potential impact of tier three and having, you know, summer rates is that weather variability can really impact revenues. This year, you know, it didn't rain very much, and so people used a lot of water. Revenues were higher. But you know, some utilities, what they do is they estimate the impact of variability and then actually adjust their financial their revenue targets based on that. And so that's something we're going to be looking into. And then, you know, this is the process. We're going to develop the metrics, get feedback from boards, commissions, and council. We're going to push for a cost of service study in 2023 utilizing these metrics, develop the model using the metrics, and then use the model in the fiscal year rate setting process in the future. This is really just about providing information. It's really about giving people information. And so with that, I think we would like any feedback that you have on this undertaking that will take up some amount of time. Yeah.
Brent Stober at 5604 Saddle Ridge Drive, Columbia, Missouri. And I also have the opportunity to serve in my daytime job as a director for utility management services for HDR. We're a large international consulting firm and focused on water and wastewater utilities. And David, I'm just proud that we're going in this direction as a community, because this is, for everyone else, this is the standard of, this is not the standard of practice. This is where the practice is going. So I know you've had a lot of leadership in the field to help progress some of these concepts and ways of looking at things. And I think the equity in our rates is a significant issue that we have. You know, I personally can afford lower usage plumbing fixtures and so forth. Now my daughters discount that efficiency quite a bit by the amount of water that they use. But regardless, I mean, a lot of households can't afford that, or in rental properties, you know, some landlords may not invest in that as well. So I think this is a great topic to bring forward for our community. I also think, you know, your point on climate impacts or the risk that we have in our rate models around climate impacts when we, especially with the tiered systems that we have, is a significant issue. And even in other areas like, say, Southern California right now, when you have a volumetric charge and our volume is going down because of demands going down, puts us in an awkward spot as a utility, or our utilities are in an awkward spot of explaining the benefits of reducing demand while also having to increase rates because there's just a cost of doing business that has to be borne by the customers. And so I think that look into the susceptibility of our rate structure to have unintended consequences is a significant issue to bring forward. So thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hi, Julie Ryan, Como Safe Water Coalition. So I guess I can't help but wonder that with the amount of consultant reports that have been done over the past decade that we have dug into over and over again, what would we be looking at in terms of water rates if we'd actually implemented or held accountable anybody in the city to have effectively implemented any of the things we paid for all of these consultants to tell us? So I really believe that that's something that this board should be responsible for. As Como Safe Water Coalition, we've gone over these reports many times. We're talking about reports that date back to about 2008, 2009, when the city was first in violation for TTHM, with many recommendations and many reports that were not acted upon and nobody was held accountable. There's a big disconnect between these projects and the expectations of what should happen. I'd also like to point out that when we talk about conservation, when we talk about what should happen with revenue being driven based on whether our weather and our climate tells us that we're going to have irrigation, we have been advocating as Como Safe Water Coalition for years between the Water and Light Advisory Board and Council to plan for secondary irrigation lines. This is something that is seen in many communities. I came from a community where they had this. We had secondary, non-potable irrigation lines, and with the amount of development that has come in this community since Chemo Safe Water Coalition has started in 2016, this is something we've advocated for and that we believe is something that can happen and is feasible. Those are water lines that are metered separately from drinking water, from sanitary water. They're being used for irrigation purposes, and it provides us with a different mechanism to monitor our supply demand and our rate structure. Thank you.
Really? Any other comments? All right. Thank you so much. The next thing we're going to talk about, and I'll turn it over to Greg and Tom on this, is our plans for the upcoming year. And so beyond the water metrics, which is one of the big ones, what we're going to be doing next.
Yeah, what I want to kind of share is we recognize we needed to better define our focus and set really some goals and objectives for the task force to make sure we're staying on task and advising the city utilities on what they need to be working on and following through on. And so the areas that we're not going to go through the whole details, but the areas we're kind of looking at or categories is really our renewable energy portfolio and where it goes from here, from what we currently have, expectations in city ordinance. We're also going to be looking at demand side management and our efficiency programs to see where there's opportunities for further enhancement. It's a great program, but there's always room for improvement in any program. We're going to be working on, as David talked about, you know, the metrics, the working towards developing a really proactive rate planning structure and not just trying to play catch up every time we have a need, a capital need or some other regulatory need that we're playing catch up with a rate in order to find the funds to pay for those projects. Communication, as we talked about, we felt like our board is focused on a specific area, but we cross over in other boards and commissions, and we want to make sure that we're staying in communication with those as well. So that's a focus area for our goals. AMI is a big project for the community. It's going to be a multi-year project, and I think we can be a good voice for the public as well as the council on that large project as it moves forward. The electric line extension policy. We kind of see that there's opportunity for improvement with that for the development that goes on in our community to make sure it's fair. We also want to kind of oversee and encourage a legal and operational assessment of all the city's fossil fuel PPAs. There's quite a few. And a lot of things, changes are going to happen in the next decade, and we need to make sure that we understand our obligations as well as our flexibility with those contracts. And lastly, the IERMP, the whole master planning effort, we want to make sure we follow through, and the recommendations that were made by Siemens, that they're moving forward and getting council approval for all the various projects and programs that were recommended by that large task force effort over the past several years.
Great, and I think as a part of this, the renewable energy discussion, kind of the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure bill have given some opportunities to the utility, and so Tom has prepared some comments here related to the new laws that might be useful to the city.
So I took a look at these giant things, and after developing narcolepsy, I came up with these slides. So there's a lot of great subsidies and grants that are available through some traditional structures that we've seen before with the way the Treasury and the IRS implements public-private partnership incentives in the form of tax credits, and then the Infrastructure Act. So the Infrastructure Act covers a lot of different things, but there is a lot allocated to energy and specifically utility infrastructure. So it boils down to these two basic laws. So We can go to the next slide. The IIJA is mostly in the form of grants. Some of them are kind of a specifically narrowly defined conditions. The value of the grant is limited, and that's different from the tax credit world, where you can have utility scale projects that can be as large as $500 million in cost, or in eligible costs, so even more expensive beyond that. The projects tend to be smaller scale. There's a lot that we might be able to implement for some of the ideas that we have locally, particularly with respect to our discussions this past year of battery pilot projects in partnership with the University Power Plant. They're not just specifically for energy production the way the tax credit programs are. They can be all over the board. It can involve a lot of different kind of pilot-oriented technologies to try to get those implemented in smaller scale form. And all this stuff has to be applied for. And because this law was passed in at the end of 2021, the regulatory guidance has been issued in almost every instance, and these programs are up and running, and we should be throwing our hat in the ring. As some of us are aware, and I'm sure many of you have heard me harp about this, during the 2008 economic downturn with the Troubled Asset Relief Program, it was very broadly defined, and a few utilities, only a few, threw their hat in the ring to get some things that were way ahead of the curve, and they got it for free. And our idea is, you know, why saddle our local ratepayers with the expenses for things that, well, we can pursue through these programs? It's part of the reason this law was passed, bipartisan. So we should chase what we can while we can. Some specifics here: electric vehicle infrastructure, charging stations, and then also developing different types of fuel sources that are not necessarily clean energy oriented the way the Inflation Reduction Act tends to focus. Hydrogen, natural gas, and propane as fuel sources. We've talked a little bit about in the past where Columbia was. We have our renewable natural gas plant at the landfill. And so there, it's possible that we will qualify for some of the upgrades that we may need over the course of the next handful of years, with subsidies and grants to support those expenses. programs to improve the electric grid, and a lot of this stuff. This is where we get to looking at our capital improvement project list, that and some things, including the power line extensions, where we need to shore up our N-1-1 challenges, bringing us to the big debate between option A and option W, I think is what we talked about. A lot of those expenses associated with that specific project align with some grants that are available. And you know, to the extent that we can offset some of the inflationary effects of the total expenses of those anticipated costs, we need to be active trying to pursue some of those grants to help help bring us back to parity with what we thought the project would cost way back when, irrespective of the path we choose, whether it's the route that the task force recommended or the route that staff is currently recommending. Some of the funds are going to be from Department of Transportation. Some of those funds are going to be distributed to states to administer. But a lot of it is stuff that we can go directly to the federal level source with our grant applications. And just here's a couple of ideas or some specific things that jumped out to me. Weatherization technologies and equipment, monitoring control. These are all things that are just ongoing necessities for any utility. So they are ongoing opportunities for us to pursue. Microgrids and battery storage. I mentioned the potential project with University of Missouri, and AMI that's on the list here. So if we go move on. And then here's a few projects that are a little bit outside of some of the things we've specifically discussed lately, but I pulled them out of the text because they relate to some of the things that we're trying to accomplish here in the city. Maybe not, passenger and freight rail. We have COLT. There may be some opportunities to apply for some grants that could help boost and support the utility of that particular asset. Environmental remediation will always impact any kind of community, particularly communities looking to grow with heavy industry as we are on Route B. Airports and aviations, yeah, we did our ribbon cutting, but there may be some opportunities for us to enhance what we've already built with some grants that are available. Water and wastewater, David's already covered a lot of that. Some of the ambition that we have for continued improvements there may be available. And of course, we already have a broadband infrastructure program or board and commission. And we know that there are a lot of expenses for that as we try to integrate widespread deployment of enhanced broadband infrastructure. So now moving on to the Inflation Reduction Act, most all the incentives are tax credit related. Most importantly, they increased the amount of eligible costs. They boosted it back up to the original statutory intent for the solar and wind tax credits of 30%. One of the best things that I think that they did for this particular program is instead of tying its sunset to a particular date on the calendar, it's instead tied to improvements or reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by the power sector using this year as a base year. And so it's projected to last at least 10 years and possibly longer. So that's a lot of time to do a huge number of transactions to create clean energy. I added move up, or maybe I need to go back. Let's see. I added a slide that talked about just generally how the deals are structured. That'll just put people to sleep. We can move past that one. There are some interesting opportunities where there are some enhancements beyond the 30% tax credit that is the core driving the clean energy movement. Some stakeholders, including tax-exempt entities, government entities, public utilities, are eligible for multiple 10% additional chunks, provided you qualify with the conditions. Some of the conditions include prevailing wage, which in this economy, I think these jobs are already being paid prevailing wage. Unfortunately, there's an apprenticeship requirement that's kind of akin to the New Deal from the Roosevelt administration, and that apprenticeship program can probably be difficult for some cities to qualify for just because you need people who are in training to do this for a living. We also don't qualify as an energy efficiency community, which is another one of the conditions for 10%. I think we won't qualify. We have to wait for more guidance to come out because it's tied to the unemployment rate. And here in Columbia, we have a very low unemployment rate, which I think is a couple of ticks at least below the national average. And some of those programs are limited in size to not be utility scale. They can be no bigger than 5 megawatts. But that means that the city can jump in, staff, if they see an opportunity with real estate that we have, to jump in and undertake some projects for some municipally owned clean energy, or I shouldn't say municipally owned because there are some tax credit rules about allocation of tax credits going to taxable entities, and there's some structuring that makes this possible. But the bottom line is the city can take advantage of the maximized subsidy in certain cases, perhaps with some of the assets that we already own, to bring a little bit of clean energy production within our local umbrella into our own energy mix for control. And then I think, I'm putting myself to sleep here. There are some new rules about how you can monetize some of these subsidies, and it gives a lot of flexibility to entities like City of Columbia, because there's a new ways to you can get a direct pay payment from the Treasury Department where you don't have to deal with these complex, convoluted tax structures that involve investors, and you can also get you can also just transfer the credits themselves, which previously you couldn't do because they could only be allocated to people who are actually owners of these systems. All of this boils down to more flexibility. There may be some trade-off with some of the savings, but it allows municipal stakeholders, just like the City of Columbia, to be more creative and think more expansively about ways that they can take advantage of some of these new incentives. And these incentives will be around, as I said, more than 10 years. So it's not the giant rush shotgun start that we have in the pursuit of grants, which, of course, are going to be limited on the infrastructure side. And I think that I just kind of cover more of these details that are kind of too in the weeds, but this will be available because it was shared at a public meeting. It'll be certainly available to the public when it gets posted eventually to our website.
I think I kind of like to add, I think as you can see, we have a pretty ambitious set of plans for the coming year. We're motivated people to help advise the city utility to make sure they're moving forward for the community. But it's not a fixed plan, so it's flexible. So we welcome input from the community either this evening or through the email or showing up at one of our board meetings that we meet on a regular basis to share what's going on in your area and what we might be able to adjust and work towards improving an area that you're interested in. So again, it's a developed plan, but it's flexible.
I also wanted to mention, I'm going to blame this on my booster shot. I was supposed to say the meeting is recorded and also being live streamed. And so if you are watching online or watching later and have some comments, please either come to our meeting or you can submit through that public comment portal, you know, WLABpublic@como.gov. So I'm going to blame that on my exhaustion from my booster shot. Okay, so any input on our plans for the next year and kind of how we should move forward?
And I do want to commend the board for its professional tone tonight, and I like a lot of what I've heard about the plans in terms of AMI, and certainly you're working with the public. The thing I want to comment on, though, is not all of the recommendations in the Siemens report are appropriate to follow. The Siemens report, like the Burns and McDonald report, and like the Quanta report, confirmed we need a new transmission line. But Siemens was constrained in its analysis of where to put it and its economic development analysis was a complete house of cards. And I submitted detailed comments on that plan, and they should be in the record. I'm not going to repeat them here. I am a retired energy lawyer. I have a blog where I have tracked the effect of the failure to build the transmission line over the last 5 or so years. I live in that area of the city. Reliability has clearly declined. The Perchy Creek transformer is overloaded. The lines lack redundancy. Reliability has gone down. And it is a serious issue. That plan, that line was on time and on budget when it was stalled for purely political reasons. And we have spent a lot of money avoiding the need for that line, which is not going away because it's an engineering reality. And again, the charter puts the engineering firmly in the hands of Water and Light. I believe Water and Light would say that some version of option A is still the most cost-effective and the most reliable option, and that information should be made available to the public. And just because we had a third consultant to look at alternatives for the option A transmission line, and they came up with a report, doesn't remove option A as still the best option. So I would hope you would get that back on track and be, honest with people about the need. And I would love to see a full accounting of the millions of dollars that that stall has cost the rate-paying public, because some of us have been tracking that, and there were millions of dollars in sunk costs that were lost, and we paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in consultant reports, all of which confirmed that line was needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Other comments on plans moving forward? Okay, and so now what I'd like to do is open it up for general comments. So anything we have not addressed yet that you would like to address for 3 minutes, we are happy to take general input beyond the topics we have discussed so far. Yeah. 3 minutes on whatever you want. Yep.
Okay.
Nope, you're good.
Okay. Julie Ryan, Como Safe Water Coalition. So I would love to see this board have like this much more investment in the water side than the power side. As somebody who spent about a year and a half going to Water and Light Advisory Board meetings and sitting there when they were from 8 a.m. till about 2 p.m., and watching all the electric information, and would love to see the water side be a little more represented. That being said, also the Water and Light Advisory Board meetings, I appreciate that you all offered this evening, even though it was maybe not promoted as much as I would have liked to have seen. 8 a.m. on a Wednesday morning does preclude a vast majority of members of the community to be a part of those meetings, which is something that we have struggled with in the last few years for as people who have full-time positions that do not allow us to be at that type of meeting. In terms of water quality goals, we feel that the board has not embraced that enough to promote that with staff, with council, and that is something that we would like to see done. The other thing that we have brought up recently is the source water protection plan. We would love to see that reestablished and reactivated. It was something that the board, none of you all were on the board at that time when it was disbanded, but we would like to see that task force reestablished, because we do not believe that the activities that were turned over to staff when it was disbanded were actually acted upon and implemented. And so we would like to see the board at this time reactivate that board as a group of community stakeholders that are protecting our source water and making sure that things like our USGS report and that contract are being evaluated and attributed to our source water. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Other general comments? All right, I think any comments from the board? I just want to thank those of you who came out and for your comments. That was my comment as a board member, and then any comments from staff. Okay, if nobody else has any comments, I think I should probably need a motion, right, to end the meeting. Would that be
motion to adjourn?
Second.
Moved by Greg, seconded by Tom. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you so much for coming.